What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. We are so pleased to be here with you. We have a wonderful show for you tonight. We are making history because we are actually the first post-election interview with Jill Stein and Butch Ware. You are seeing it here. That's right. Historic moment. First election, post-election interview with Jill Stein and Butch Ware. They, of course, ran for president. They were running mates and they ran for president in the 2024 election. And so we'll be talking a lot about a lot of different things with them. And also, we are so honored to be bringing back to the show an extremely popular guest, a incredibly informed, astute, insightful analyst, Moon Rabbani, who is a Dutch-Palestinian analyst, co-editor of Jadalia, and non-resident fellow at the Center for Conflict and Humanitarian Studies. He was previously senior analyst at Middle East and special advisor on Israel-Palestine with the International Crisis Group and head of political affairs with the Office of United Nations Special Envoy for Syria. He's a contributor to the book Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. So welcome, Muin.
Hi, Katie. Very good to be with you again.
Thank you so much for joining. And
thank you for having me.
You are so such a great source of so much information, and you're especially well positioned to talk about the alleged pogroms that took place in Amsterdam, because you yourself are Dutch Palestinian and you're from the Netherlands. And, you know, this is not just a story about what happened in Amsterdam. This is a story about media bias, police brutality, anti-Palestinian racism and bigotry. And it's a very important case study. But we're going to get into the media bias and the, you know, the way that these people were treated. But tell us, first set up for us what happened, please.
Well, what happened, just by way of background, for many years, the Palestinian Football Association and activists operating under the rubric of Red Card for Israel have been petitioning the International Soccer Federation, FIFA, and the European Soccer Federation, UEFA, to ban the Israeli Football Association, the IFA, from its competitions on the same grounds that were used to suspend the membership of the white minority regime in South Africa and the former Rhodesia. And the position of these bodies has consistently been sports and politics don't mix. Well, that pretext fell apart in February of 2022, when literally within days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, within 100 hours, both bodies suspended the Russian Football Association and every single Russian club. So by refusing to take their responsibility, they kind of laid the basis for what happened in Holland earlier this month. The second responsibility falls with the Dutch government. The current Dutch prime minister, kind of Holland's answer to J. Edgar Hoover, he's the former spy chief, and he apparently couldn't figure out the risks involved in allowing this game to continue, particularly not just with any Israeli team, but with one that even by Israeli standards is known for the racism and genocidal fanaticism of its supporters. The game was allowed to continue. The several thousand Maccabi supporters came to the Netherlands, as is common when a team has an away game. And once they arrived in Amsterdam, rather than engaging supporters of the home team, Ajax Amsterdam, in kind of hooliganism and clashes, as is not all that uncommon in the world of football, soccer, whatever you want to call it, they started engaging the locals, particularly those of Arab appearance, who tended to be primarily Dutch Moroccans, and also those who had visible signs of solidarity with the Palestinian people, either because they were wearing keffiyehs or they had Palestinian flags flying from their homes. So there were assaults on passersby based on their appearance. There were vandalism of private homes and so on. And one particular target was taxi drivers, because a large proportion of them are Dutch Moroccans. And those taxi drivers, we're still talking before the game, those taxi drivers then banded together and responded with an assault on the football hooligans. And this is kind of what happened before the game and then escalated further after the game. And I think the other factor to bear in mind is that the Amsterdam police force, I think like most police forces in the Western world, is institutionally racist and effectively functioned as a protective guard around the Israeli hooligans. And when these clashes broke out, it was immediately presented as a pogrom, as a racist, anti-Semitic act whose sole motivation was hatred of Jews and whose sole purpose was to go after Jews. Well, the only targets of this pogrom were these Israeli soccer hooligans who had been engaging not only in violence themselves and assaults, largely under police protection, but they had also been going through the center of Amsterdam, yelling racist and genocidal chants, their favorite slogan, pretty much Israel's national anthem, death to the Arabs, may your village burn, there are no schools left in Gaza because all the children are dead, and so on and so forth. And this was then immediately presented by the media as a, first of all, as a pogrom, second of all, as one that was conducted by the Muslims, you know, primarily Dutch of Moroccan background. And, you know, it just went on from there. And not a single Dutch leading politician came out in defense of their own citizens. The mayor of Amsterdam, instead of coming out in defense of her residents, basically, as she later admitted, parroted the line on this incident put forward by none other than the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu that same night, that this was a pogrom against Jews. Well, a pogrom against Jews would be directed not only at violent Israeli soccer hooligans chanting genocidal chants through the center of Amsterdam, one would anticipate that it would also be directed at, for example, Dutch Jews and Dutch Jewish institutions and Dutch Jewish properties. But there was none of that, even though on the same night, the Jewish community of Amsterdam was holding its commemoration of Kristallnacht, which, you know, the notorious ransacking and murder of Jews and Jewish property in Germany, Nazi Germany, in 1938. That same night, the commemoration of that event was held in the Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam. Now, the Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam is a very well-known landmark. Yet there were no disturbances there. There was no attempt to attack or ransack it. So this was very much a clash between the Israeli soccer hooligans and those they had attacked and vandalized. Were there anti-Semitic slurs expressed during that night? Yes, there were. There were a few instances. Nothing compared to the almost uniformly anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian genocidal chants being shouted and screamed by the Israeli hooligans. But there was, to be clear, instances of anti-Semitism by those who were attacking the hooligans. But that was then used to generalize about the whole event, that it was somehow should be seen in the context of the European history of anti-Semitism, of Kristallnacht, of the Holocaust, rather than being seen in its proper context, Israel, what Israel is doing in the Gaza Strip, and most specifically, the conduct of these violent, racist, genocidal Israeli football hooligans.
And right, and that's, of course, one of the many examples of how Israel is contributing to anti-Semitism, because they live stream this genocide and claim to act in the name of Jews. And then you have people like on this, the Maccabee fans, and there's the image of the Jewish star. So while I'm not, condoning statements of anti-Semitism, it certainly, I would say, is much more understandable than people chanting overtly racist things about Palestinians. And as you've pointed out, the condemnation of anti-Semitism as a generalization based on a few comments, we don't see the equivalent condemnation of what the Maccabee people were doing based on their much more prevalent racist comments.
Yes, and I'm not talking about the Dutch leadership and leading Dutch politicians refusing to say anything in support of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, whose mass murder and extermination was being openly advocated by these Israeli hooligans. I'm talking about Dutch citizens, residents of Amsterdam, who were being violently assaulted and whose properties were being vandalized by these people. And neither the mayor of Amsterdam, nor the Dutch prime minister, nor the leader of the Dutch opposition, nor any prominent member of any of the coalition partners, nor any Dutch government minister uttered a single word in defense of the victims of these hooligans. Rather, they demonized and delegitimized these victims. And you began to see calls, for withdrawing their citizenship and expelling them from the country and so on. And this, I think the missing part of the story and much of the coverage is that this was not only about, what actually happened that we saw on our televisions, or rather what was distorted by the media, but there's another important element of this, and this has to do with Dutch politics, which I can get into if you're interested, but I'm not sure it's relevant.
Yeah, definitely. Should we show the media bias first and then you get into the Dutch politics?
Sure.
Whichever order you want. So let's take a look. Double Down News, which is a great, great, great YouTube channel and production house, put together a really informative video. They often do these. And here we're going to see a journalist named Richard Sanders, who breaks down some of the media bias that was on display around the Amsterdam incident. So let's take a look at that.
Disinformation. Now, let's make our focus here a very specific bit of footage. If you watch, certainly the initial reports from the BBC, The Guardian, CNN, and other outlets, they all rely very heavily on a specific bit of footage of individuals in the street being attacked by a mob of hooded men.
Crowds of people assaulted Israeli fans after Thursday night's match.
Israel said that Israeli supporters were attacked in a very violent incident as they left the ground.
Vicious attacks upon people purely because they're Israelis and Jews.
This was continuously used to illustrate the violence that Maccabee Tel Aviv supporters had suffered. The Times of India used in its footage and even went so far as to refer to it as Israeli nationals abducted in Hamas-style attack. Now, that footage was shot by a local citizen journalist called Annette de Graaf, who I've spoken to quite a bit over the last few days. Her footage does not show Israeli fans being attacked at all. In fact, it shows the precise opposite. The mobs of hooded figures we see in that footage are Maccabi Tel Aviv fans. If you look very carefully at Annette's footage, you can see that a number of individuals are wearing blue and yellow, which are the Maccabi colours. The people they are attacking are individual Dutch citizens. Annette goes online, actually says, no, hang on. The footage doesn't show that. It shows the exact opposite. She is ignored. She starts having to interact with various news agencies, pleading with them to change the way they are using her own footage. Firstly, Reuters, terribly important because Reuters provides footage to other news organizations around the world. With the footage, what Reuters distributes is a thing called a dope sheet. This is a basic explanation to their clients of what they're looking at, what this footage is. Now, Annette spoke to Reuters at enormous length very early in the morning on the Friday, the day after the violence, and explained to them, gave them chapter and verse, told them exactly what this was. The following evening, they rang back. They clearly weren't terribly satisfied with this and quizzed her again. And she was absolutely emphatic. The people committing the violence here are Maccabi Tel Aviv fans. Now, I've obtained a copy of the Reuters dope sheet for this one. It begins, clashes broke out outside Amsterdam Central Station in the early hours of Friday, November the 8th, in what Israeli authorities said was an attack targeting Israeli citizens. Their opening line, despite what Anna has told them, continues to frame it with the Maccabi fans as being the victims here. It then does address what Annette had told them. An eyewitness at the scene claims these people are fans of Maccabi Tel Aviv. However, Reuters cannot independently verify this claim. Now, that is quite extraordinary. She's not an eyewitness at the scene. She is the originator of the material. And she's not guessing. She had been following this mob of hooligans for a quarter of an hour. She knows damn well who they are. So the next morning, something very interesting happens. A woman called Alice Porter, a reporter for Sky News, produces a very unusual report. It absolutely stands out from all the other reporting, not because it's an exceptional bit of journalism. It's a bog-standard bit of journalism. It's an accurate description of what had happened in Amsterdam. And within hours, it was taken down, and Sky re-edited it and put it up again with a note saying the previous version did not meet their standards for balance and impartiality. And the most striking bit is they continue to use Annette's footage. In her original piece, Alice Porter had said,
Maccabi fans were seen attacking locals as a police car can be seen driving by.
By the time you get to the re-edited version, that script line has become,
a video posted on social media shows a large group of hooded men dressed in black running down the street and striking people at random.
What has happened there, Sky News, who know perfectly well what this footage shows and had originally accurately reported it, is now pretending that it doesn't know, basically to lie to their viewers.
So there you have it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of new standards of imbalance and partiality set by the media, the corporate media, the Western corporate media during the past year with respect to Gaza, with respect to Palestinians, with respect to Arabs more generally. And although no one was killed in Amsterdam, I think the thorough, deliberate, premeditated, systematic distortion of what really happened in Amsterdam in order to put forward this thoroughly false account, which reflects Israel's propaganda line, and to basically extend the narrative that, you know, what happened in Amsterdam is a pogrom against Jews, just as what's happening in the Middle East is not a genocide of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, but rather also a pogrom and against Jews. I think this Amsterdam story, even taking into account all the lies, fabrications, distortions, and so on that we've seen during the past year, I think this one really set an absolutely new depth, new standard, if you will, of imbalance and partiality, to coin a phrase used by Sky News.
Yeah.
And you know, you have also, sorry, just on the same, this video taken by the citizen, Dutch citizen journalist, Annette de Graaf, the New York Times used it as well. And when they finally felt compelled to issue a correction, and I think Electronic Intifada ran a story about this recently, when they were finally forced to issue a correction, they didn't issue a correction. They simply deleted the video, because if the video doesn't fit into the propaganda narrative, well, if you know, you're certainly not going to give an accurate rendition of events, you just delete the story.
That actually reminds me of Jamie Lee Curtis early on, like I think maybe it was October of 2023. She, in all her infinite stupidity, put on Instagram an image that was from the New York Times, and it showed a few young children. One of them was carrying another child, and they were looking up at the sky. And she wrote something like "Terror from the Skies" and is an Israeli flag or something. And people pointed out, actually, those are Palestinian kids. And instead of pretending to care about Palestinians and correcting it and saying, you know, both sides are suffering or end the war or doing some like both sizing thing, no, she just deleted the post.
Yes, because even an anodyne statement of concern for all human life is unacceptable in the situation. 99% partiality is treason.
Right.
It's either 110% or you're an enemy.
Right, exactly, yeah. What were you going to say, by the way, about Dutch politics?
Well, the context here is that the Netherlands recently had an election in which the far right emerged as the largest party. Didn't win a majority. No party ever wins a majority in Dutch parliamentary elections. But traditionally, the leader of the largest party is appointed as a prime minister. And in the case of the most recent elections, the leader of the largest party is Geert Wilders, who basically makes Trump look like a social democrat. And he managed to find three other parties who were willing to form a coalition with him, but only on condition that he not assume the prime ministership, because they felt he would be too big of an embarrassment to the country on the European and international stage. He agreed, and then he appointed Dick Schoof, the former spy chief, as a prime minister. And so, and then also the mayor of Amsterdam, Femke Halsema, is the former leader of the Green Left Party. And she kind of represents everything, Wilders and, you know, the other parties on the right and the far right. Hey, I mean, she's been subjected to more sexism and misogynistic abuse from Wilders and his people than we've seen in the entire history of Islam in recent years. So the context here is that you know, in addition to what actually happened in Amsterdam, you have this polarization, this conflict, the struggle for power and dominance between left and right, between the right and the far right, and most intensively within the far right. So what happened is that all these people, all these leaders, began grandstanding, trying to outdo each other in demonizing their own citizens, particularly, you know, as very similar, I should add, to the way people in Europe spoke about Jews in the late 19th and early 20th century. It's uncanny, the resemblance. And, you know, these people don't, speaking about Muslims, and particularly Dutch of Moroccan background, because, you know, to these ignoramuses, Arabs and Muslims are always conflated. You know, these people don't belong here. They don't share our norms and values. We have to get rid of them. And there's now actual proposals to make anti-Semitism a terrorist offense on the basis of which people convicted can have their citizenship revoked if they have a second citizenship, which many do, and deported. So, you know, we're really beginning to see this kind of exclusionary race baiting. And it wasn't just Wilders. I mean, the prime minister himself was engaged in this. And again, trying to point out that the real aggressors here were the Dutch of Moroccan background, even though they were hardly the only ones who fought back against the hooligans. And of course, the innocent angelic victims in this story, just as in the Gaza Strip, are of course the Israelis. So I think political context is just important because it explains a lot of the grandstanding, a lot of the extremist rhetoric about pogroms and anti-Semitism and so on. And it's still continuing and in fact escalating. Interestingly, the mayor of Amsterdam, who is as guilty of this as anyone else, has now backtracked and said she shouldn't have used the term pogrom and that she should have come out in defense of those who live in the city that she leads. And most remarkably, in making that statement, she said the reason she called it a pogrom was because Netanyahu had. So basically, shamelessly, without batting an eyelid in public, she admitted that she was simply parroting what the Israeli prime minister said. And, you know, Wilders, this far-right leader, he's already been convicted by a Dutch court of discrimination. And in 2014, at a public rally, he said, you know, do you want more or less Moroccans? And the crowd started chanting less, less, less. He said, well, we're going to arrange that. I mean, these things are not entirely foreign to Dutch or European history, if one goes back a century. And the thing about all these people is, if you look at the way they talk about Palestinians, the way they talk about Arabs, the way they talk about Muslims, if they made half these statements, if they made even a quarter of these statements about Jews, they would all be, rightfully, I should add, in prison by the existing law. But you know, when you're talking about the weakest and most vulnerable members of society, as is so often the case, anything goes, and the more the merrier.
And what's even scarier is that if they said comments like this about Israelis or Zionists, not about Jews, but God, if they forbid, made comments like that, they would be treated like anti-Semites. And we're going to get into why that's so dangerous.
Yes.
But, you know, let's actually take trigger warning, everyone. I just want to take a look at what Netanyahu said, which is, of course, a disgusting weaponization of the history of the Holocaust. But let's take a look at what he said.
Yesterday, we marked the Kristallnacht that happened 86 years ago on European soil. It was a brutal and violent attack against Jews just because they were Jews. Unfortunately, in the last few days, we saw pictures that recall that night. In the streets of Amsterdam, anti-Semitic rioters attacked Jews, Israeli citizens, just because they were Jews. But there's one big difference between that night and our time. Today, we have a state.
So just an explicit linking of self-defense and Holocaust prevention with Israel's genocide, right? So they love creating these anti-Semitism scares because then that links it back to, and this is why, unfortunately, we have to be doing what we're doing today.
Yeah. And of course, Netanyahu has a history of this. A few years ago, he actually stated in public that the Holocaust was not Hitler's idea.
Oh, right, right.
That he had to be persuaded to do it by the Palestinian leader at the time, Haj Amin al-Husseini. Now, imagine if anyone else had said that Hitler had not really thought of the Holocaust or had not really wanted to perpetrate it, but had to be persuaded by a third party, you know. But when Netanyahu says
Holocaust
it,
denial,
it's okay. We pretend it never happened.
Right.
And again, you know, this constant conflation of Jews and Israelis, of Jews and Zionism. Of course, anti-Semitism is everywhere and always inadmissible, irrespective of the motivations and the context. Having said that, you know, the constant deliberate effort to obfuscate any distinction between Jews and Israelis, between Judaism and Zionism, is creating real dangers, you know, among people who don't know better and take these people at their word. Oh, so you're telling me there is no difference between what Israel is doing in Gaza and my Jewish neighbors just going about their normal lives? You know, you're telling me they're one and the same? And this is, you know, the irony is that Israel, which advertises itself as having been established as a safe haven for persecuted Jews in the context of the long history of European anti-Semitism culminating in the Holocaust, today, as many people have noted, presents the greatest threat to Jews. Not only is Israel in many ways today the unsafest place to be for Jews because of all the wars it has started, but it's also one that is increasingly creating dangers for Jews abroad.
Right, and I'm going to play something. I don't usually like show my own tweets, but I do want to show just this one thing that I tweeted today because it relates to what you're saying. And then I'm going to show a clip of you saying what you just said very powerfully. Let's see. Stop Anti-Semitism tweeted out, AOC is blaming the Jews for the Democrats losing the House, Senate, and White House. Color us shocked. And this is because she had tweeted, if people want to talk about members of Congress being overly influenced by a special interest group pushing a wildly unpopular agenda that pushes voters away from the Democrats, then they should be discussing AIPAC, right? Now, what the ironically titled Stop Anti-Semitism Twitter account does is conflates Jews with AIPAC, which of course is in itself anti-Semitic, and as you were saying, makes Jews less safe. And I wrote, you are the anti-Semites. You conflate being Jewish and being a Zionist. You push the anti-Semitic dual loyalty trope. You and Israel put us in danger by claiming the genocide their live streaming is in our name. It's not anti-Zionism. It's not anti-Semitic. Zionism is. And you had a very powerful exchange with someone where you made a very related point. You were in debating someone named Joseph Cohen, who's the founder of the Israel Advocacy Movement on Eli Hassell's YouTube show. And let's take a look at how you responded to his playing the anti-Semitism card.
Solution. That is disgusting anti-Semitic racism at its finest.
You know, you wave around this accusation of anti-Semitism like it's some kind of magic.
Not wanting Jews in your land is anti-Semitic.
You just wave your wand, any criticism will go away. You just have to say anti-Semitism this, anti-Semitism that. You've turned it into an entirely meaningless slogan, a meaningless slogan that people are beginning to take pride in because you have redefined it into criticism of illegal Israeli policies and practices. Anti-Semitism, my friend, is the hatred of Jews on the basis of their identity. Criticism of illegal Israeli policies and practices, criticism of genocide. You want to trivialize anti-Semitism by applying the term to these kinds of things? You've cheapened it, you've trivialized it, you have made it an entirely meaningless and contemptible term, the main victims of which are going to be Jews who experience genuine anti-Semitism.
Yeah, which is, please.
No, I think he was accusing me of disgusting anti-Semitism for pointing out that illegal Israeli settlers and illegal Israeli settlements in the illegally occupied West Bank had no right to be there.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And of course, that I can't believe you said that, Muin. You desecrate the memories of, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know how these people can keep saying that. But, you know, it's like, as you pointed out, obviously, I mean, and we're going to talk about this more, that I always feel conflicted almost even talking about the anti-Semitism question, because they're using it, Israel is using it as such an obvious deflection from the crimes against humanity that they're committing against Palestinians. And we're going to return that to that theme. But it is worth noting that it's not, I mean, it's worth noting that this is not good for Jews. This is what they're doing is good for a certain political project, and it puts other Jews at risk. Like, other Jews have to pay the price for Zionism.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you cry wolf once too often, you may well end up getting devoured by the real thing.
And speaking of the way that, you know, Israel loves to pretend that in this political context, they are the, you know, they are once again the Jews that, but for the state of Israel, would be killed and genocided. And the Palestinians are the Nazis, right? Which they also love comparing Palestinians to Nazis. No one else can use like the Holocaust in any analogy except for Israel. But I mean, this was, I just want to share an image that is so disturbing. This is of outside of a hospital, and you're going to see patients right here who are, I mean, tell me who this, what this reminds you of. How does someone look at this? I mean, look at these are people who are like on, some of them are on crutches. One of them has like a drainage thing connected to them. How do people look at this humiliation and sadism and say, yeah, the Jews, the Israelis are the victims of anti-Semitism? How do they look at that and not say, wow, the Palestinians are the people who we used to look at under Nazism? Like, these are the Jews of it.
Well, I mean, I think the context here, of course, is that Israel was established some 3 years after World War II, just, you know, after the Holocaust, and particularly in its early years, trying to present its conflicts with its enemies, those it had dispossessed, its neighboring countries, whose lands it occupied, and so on, trying to present that conflict as not something caused by what Israel was doing to the Palestinians and to the region, but rather as an extension of the horrors that were still so fresh in people's minds about what happened in Europe. Let's face it, it was extraordinarily effective. And in that context, even a whiff of an accusation of anti-Semitism immediately placed you outside any legitimate debate and discussion. You know, and you look at how Israel used to characterize its enemies and adversaries. Egypt, Jamal Abdel Nasser was Hitler on the Nile. Saddam Hussein was a new Hitler. Yasser Arafat was in Beirut during the invasion of 1982, was Hitler in his bunker. I mean, everyone is Hitler, you know. And let's face it, it was extraordinarily effective, particularly in Europe, where the Holocaust took place, and where people would, you know, make every reasonable and unreasonable effort not to be tainted with the accusation of anti-Semitism, because it was a career ender, if not more so. The problem is it became too effective, and particularly now, you know, we're no longer in the 20th century, we're well into the 21st century, and to simply wave around anti-Semitism, like I said, as a magic wand, you know, anytime someone criticizes any Israeli policy, no matter how depraved, to just say anti-Semitism that, anti-Semitism that, it's wearing thin, and people are no longer intimidated the way they used to be, both because Israel and its apologists and flunkies have become so cavalier in throwing this accusation around, and because people also have a much better understanding than they did in decades past about what Israel actually is and what Israel is actually doing. Growing, I mean, internationally, particularly the global South, what Israel is and what Israel does has more or less always been understood by many people who share similar history with the Palestinians. But in the West now, you know, the realization that Israel is actually an irrational, genocidal, apartheid state addicted to solving political challenges with overwhelming displays of force and violence, with arms supplied by Western countries. That realization is, I think, not only growing, but growing at an accelerating pace. And so Israel's response to that has been, and its apologists, has been to wave these accusations around with abandon and even more intensely than ever before. So now, you know, you have groups, you know, this against anti-Semitism, that against anti-Semitism. You know, you see it being used to stifle discussion and debate on university campuses and elsewhere. Well, it's no longer working the way it used to. And that's the real problem for Israel and its flunkies.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, something that is related to all that we're talking about, the dehumanization of Palestinians, the media bias, and this is why I thought the Amsterdam story was so important, because whenever you can find cases of media bias, it's really important to point them out, because people won't realize media bias. It's very hard to realize, because you have to compare what actually happened to what you're seeing on your screens. And if so, it's hard for people to know what's being misrepresented. Yeah. But, you know, one of the things that I think I mention almost like every show or very frequently, because it's just so galling, is the total double standard in the coverage of rape. And we have Dana Bash, Jake Tapper, Kamala Harris, Sheryl Sandberg, Hillary Clinton talking about this Hamas mass rape hoax. I'll call it a hoax. They talk.
It's
a hoax. I always say that in case I don't want to get other people in trouble when they appear with me. But okay, it is a hoax. So you'll say that too. They talk about the rape that there is no evidence of, and they talk about it as if it's real. And it would be one thing if they did that, but also mentioned the rape of Palestinians, the rapes of Palestinians. That would show at least. Maybe you think they're misinformed or they don't know any better, because let's face it, the media is perpetuating this. But knowing that there has been documented cases of rape that's been covered by the Israeli media, knowing that there were protests against the arrest of rapists, knowing that a member of the Knesset said it was, quote, legitimate, end quote, to, quote, insert sticks into people's rectums, end quote, knowing that there was a rabbi who blessed one of these rapists, and knowing that these rapists appear on Israeli television, the only way you can fail to cover that is because you absolutely don't care about rape and sexual violence. You don't care about Palestinians. You just care about it, ironically, as a weapon of war, a weapon of genocide. And I wanted to play a clip of an extremely disturbing story about a doctor. We actually had covered this a long time ago because we knew that this incredibly selfless, brave doctor, Adnan Al-Bursh, who refused to leave his patients, we knew he was killed in Israeli custody. And now there's a new Sky News report. And again, as we just pointed out, Sky News is not exactly biased towards Palestinians and anti-Israel, which makes this all the more shocking. But let's just take a look at this clip.
This is the recovery room, full darkness, no water, no electricity. But we have a hero, surgeons in Gaza.
These are the words of Dr. Adnan Al-Bursh, one of the best-known surgeons in Gaza, as he documented the situation at Al-Shifa Hospital last year. The conditions were deteriorating in the weeks that followed October 7th, so bad, in fact, there was nowhere left to store the bodies. Here, Al-Bursh and colleagues dig mass graves in the hospital compound. The Israelis said Al-Shifa was used as a command and control center by Hamas, and they placed it under siege. Patients, staff, and displaced residents were forced to evacuate. But Al-Bursh took a different path. The beginning of his story in Israeli detention. He worked at several hospitals nearby, these pictures taken at Al Alda Hospital, the last images we have of Dr. Al-Bursh. He was detained several days later after the hospital director said the men had to leave. His colleague, Dr. Mohammed Obaid, was with him at the time.
ولقد قالوا له حرفيا اذا لم ياتي جميع الرجال الموجودون في الداخل فسيقوموا بتدمير مستشفى العوده وما فيه.
These drone images match his description of events. Obaid says the Israelis took 5 medical workers away, including Alberch. A human rights lawyer has obtained a deposition from a prisoner at Ofa who said he witnessed the moments leading up to the doctor's death.
He had clearly been assaulted with injuries around his body. He was naked in the lower part of his body. The prison guard threw him in the middle of the yard and left him there.
The deposition says Alberch was taken by an inmate to one of the cells.
A few minutes later, prisoners were heard screaming from the room they went into, declaring Dr. Adnan Alberch have been martyred.
Yeah, and, you know, yet we have absolute silence on this from Dan Abash and nonstop discussion of Palestinian violence against Israelis.
You know, just going back to Amsterdam, I think it was Philip Proudfoot on Twitter who said it's the first time that world leaders have expressed thoughts and prayers in solidarity with football hooligans. Oh, yeah. And so now here, you know, what's often said about these Israeli narratives is that every accusation is a confession. And I believe it was Sarah Leah Whitson who said, every accusation is not only a confession, but a statement of intent. Mm. And so here you had, you know, the mass rape hoax of October 7th. And by hoax, I'm not referring to, I'm not suggesting there were absolutely no incidents of sexual violence or gender-based violence, but this constant story that's being repeated to this very day, that there was an organized, right, premeditated campaign of systematic rape and sexual violence on October 7th. There is absolutely no evidence for that, for the simple reason that, like the Amsterdam pogrom, it simply didn't happen. What we do know is that we had this Israeli detention center in southern Israel, Sde Teiman, which effectively functioned as a torture center and also as a center for rape of prisoners, primarily men, being not only raped, but also gang raped, and also being raped by trained German shepherds and the like. And in the case of Dr. Adnan Alberch, he was arrested in November or December, I believe. He was head of the pediatric department at Al Shifa Hospital, you know, the famous Hamas Pentagon that wasn't, and had moved to different hospitals and ultimately was in Al Awda Hospital in the northern Gaza Strip, where, as the clip you just showed, the Israelis threatened that if all men between the ages of, 18 and 65, or 16 and 65, didn't immediately surrender, the entire hospital, including everyone within it, patients and all, would be bombed to smithereens. He was arrested, taken to Sde Teiman in southern Israel, and then moved to Ofir prison just outside Ramallah in the West Bank, where he had his final moments. And all the indications are that he was raped to death.
Yeah, and the silence around it is just...
Yes, because again, you know, it doesn't fit the story we're constantly being told of these absolutely beautiful, angelic, innocent Israeli victims who, genocide notwithstanding, would never hurt a fly, and these Palestinians who are evil incarnate.
Right. Well, Muin, thank you so much, as always, for your time and your insights, and we love talking to you.
Thank you very much, Katie. It was always a pleasure being with you.
Thank you. Have a great night.
You too.
Sorry, it's hard to segue out of that. It's so disturbing and upsetting. I actually want to, this actually is maybe a good segue. Let's, you know, it's so brutal and disgusting and such a violation of the never again ethos to see what Israel does. And let's actually show someone who, we're not going to show any video, but I want to acknowledge someone. We actually just spent a few days with her. Her name is Marion Ingram. She is a Holocaust survivor. There you can see her. And she has a sign that says Holocaust survivor, peace in our name. There she is with her amazing husband, Daniel Ingram, who says has a pro-Palestine sign. And Marion is one of the people, and this is a documentary that I've been working on, Brad is working on. Marion is one of the people who says never again for anyone. And who says, I, as a Holocaust survivor, have to speak out against what Israel is doing. As opposed to Israel, who says we as a nation that was founded on the Holocaust are going to inflict a Holocaust on other people. So it happens to be Marion Ingram's birthday. So I wanted to wish her a happy birthday. Happy birthday, Marion. Thank you for all you do. She's been protesting at the White House since October 2023. We were with her this weekend where she and others read the names of every 15-year-old Palestinian that we know of who has been killed. And of course, there are many more under the rubble. And she and her fellow activists have been doing that since the beginning. I mean, they started with reading the names of the babies aged 0 to 1, and now they're up to 15-year-olds. So grateful for people like Marion. And happy birthday to Marion. And we are now going to bring on our next guest. And if you haven't already given this show a like, give it a thumbs up. It's a really great way to support this show for free. Please give it a thumbs up. Also, please subscribe, hit subscribe, and then press the bell. Another free way to support this show, get these voices out there. And also, if you're not already Patreon members, please become Patreon members at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. For just $1 a month, you make the show happen. It literally couldn't happen without your support. If you do $5 a month, you get access to extended interviews and bonus interviews. So for instance, you'll get the full interview we did last week with Thomas Frank and Matt Karp. You'll also get early access to this live taping that we did in Ireland with a Palestinian guest and an Irish guest on the connections between Ireland and Palestine. And there's tons. There's literally hundreds of episodes you get access to. But without any further ado, we are going to bring on our next guests. Jill Stein is a Harvard-educated doctor, a pioneering environmental health advocate, and an organizer for People, Planet, and Peace. She was the 2024 presidential nominee for the Green Party. Butch Ware is a lifelong activist and educator specializing in the history of empire, colonialism, genocide, and revolution. He's associate professor of history at UC Santa Barbara, and he was the 2024 vice presidential nominee for the Green Party. So please welcome to the show, Butch Ware and Jill Stein.
Hi.
Hey, Katie.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining.
Great to see you.
You too. Welcome back, Jill and Butch. Thank you for coming. Is this your Katie Halper Show debut?
It is, yeah. Excited.
Historic moment. for us, at least. So, you know, you guys just ran for president. There's so much I want to ask you about, so much to talk about. But I guess my first question was, if there's anything... this is the first interview you've done since the election. And I want to just offer you the chance of anything you wanted to share with people, anything you wanted to vent, let people know about. And then I have some more particular questions, but I thought we could start off this way.
Butch, you want to...
By all means, you should lead off. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. So, I mean, mainly what I want to say is let's keep it going. You know, and I think the results of the election just validated all of the, you know, the mission and the vision of our campaign and our, you know, our shared, our shared determination that we would have an anti-genocide, anti-war, pro-worker, climate emergency, pro-democracy campaign to fight the empire and oligarchy and rising fascism. And I think, you know, we actually, it was an amazing, amazing, wonderful, wonderful campaign. And we had an absolutely exhilarating and uplifting experience for my part, you know, this is my third race in 12 years for president, that is. And in a way, you know, it's not a different race than we ran back in 2012. Same issues. We really had basically the same positions as the, you know, as the one national scale people-powered political party. And there are other great political parties, but they're not really a choice on the ballot that's fighting nationally. So, you know, that's why I say as the one. But we have so much in common with the other, you know, the other left people-powered parties. But as the one of national scale, you know, we have been ahead of the curve. I think actually all of the parties on the left have been very ahead of the curve, and the curve has caught up to us, you know, from reparations to, you know, ending the carceral state to, you know, the emergency of the climate and the Green New Deal to putting an end to crushing inequality, a $25 minimum wage, healthcare is a human right and housing is a human right. You know, and demanding really an end to genocide and an end to empire. We really represent where the American people are right now. Now, back in 2012, not everybody was there, but I think people are really there right now. We've really are done being thrown under the bus, and we have enormous power. That power is reflected in the absolute panic of the Democrats and their unprecedented use of fraud, abuse, and just, you know, outright trickery and dishonest I would say even some illegal strategies, you know, their infiltration, their spies, their use of very unsavory tactics with their corporate lawyers to throw us off the ballot. We still have some challenges that are ongoing, some that are just going to begin after the election ends. But, you know, our fight really is the same as the fight of the American people. We are the one national scale people-powered party. We don't take the, you know, the money of, you know, we're not running on billionaire money. We don't run on corporate PAC money. We don't run on super PAC money. You know, we are of, by, and for the people. And, you know, it's so funny to hear the Democrats now saying the same thing, or at least some of them. You know, they have a split critique. Their critique is that they weren't left enough, and their critique is also that they were too left, you know. So they don't exactly have a unified critique or path forward. And at the same time that they parody what we were saying, they won't acknowledge that there's anybody out there. They won't acknowledge other parties of the left or their corruption. Bernie Sanders is calling for, you know, an end to big money in politics and public financing. Well, hello, this is what we've been screaming about since the founding of the Green Party. And, you know, he still won't acknowledge that there are actually people-powered parties out there and remains a captive of the Democratic Party. So at any rate, the fight goes on, and I just have so much gratitude and solidarity with everybody out there. And I really want to urge people to keep on, you know, keep on, don't stop for a minute, and continue to work with us. If you've been doing that, we're still doing that. And you can still sign up at our website, but we'll soon be transitioning into other vehicles, and including the Green Party, which is in a great kind of launching mode right now, or maybe I should say relaunch mode right now. So really exciting what's going on. It's been a long time coming, and the momentum keeps building. And I think we come out of this stronger than ever. The numbers reflect nothing. You know, the numbers reflect an extraordinarily corrupted and suppressed process in which the wheels of, you know, of what's Chomsky's term for manufactured consent? You know, manufactured consent was just under intense, you know, it was massively intensified in this race, more than we've ever seen with the Democrats in their war room and all that. But the reality on the ground is that the resolve is just off the charts now to keep it going. And people are just utterly and completely convinced. Many people stayed home. Well, people always stay home. One out of every three eligible voters basically stays home from U.S. presidential elections. And it was many millions more, largely in progressive strongholds. So we have the numbers. We have the power. We have the solutions. as Malcolm X said, we're not outnumbered, we're just out-organized. And in particular, we're outfunded. But those are fixable, you know, and being, you know, representing the very urgent, heartfelt needs and vision of the American people, we are unstoppable. So let's keep it up.
I'm going to ask, I have a lot of follow-ups, but first I want to hear from you. Butch,
I mean, I'll try to be brief. You know, not there wouldn't be a lot of, you know, to add to what Dr. Jill has already laid out. I would maybe make a transition between your last guest and the fact that we're now 13 plus months into this genocide. The Democratic Party, you know, still refuses to actually reckon with the fact that it was this genocide and its unwillingness to take the foot off the gas of an entirely American genocide, a genocide that the Biden regime could put an end to with the same phone call that Ronald Reagan made to Menachem Begin in 1982. They could end that genocide right now, and instead they're trying to speed us headlong into nuclear World War III with continued, you know, provocation. And, you know, using American imperialist tool that is NATO. So what we're seeing is a Democratic Party completely off the rails. And just as way of election recap, I'll go back to two of my own pieces that came out in numerous, you know, kind of stump speeches. And I think, Dr. Jill, you'll correct me if this impression is wrong. But I kept saying these two things from the trail. And the first one, you guys sort of looked at me sometimes like I was, you know, crazy when I would say this. But I would say, as soon as I joined the campaign, I think the first time I'm on record saying it is like August 23rd, is I said the Democrats have no path to victory in November, and they are going to get curb stomped in this election. And people kept saying, oh, this is going to be a close election. And, you know, that and why would you say that? And there was just no way of avoiding this outcome. The polling data showed that the Muslim population, as early as January of 2024, had abandoned the Democratic Party in its entirety, going from 65% support for Biden in 2020 to polling at 12% in January 2024. And so it was clear to me that this was going to be a legendary ass kicking, you know, that and I think that we saw that in the, you know, in the popular, vote. We saw that in the Electoral College result. And that then is tethered to a second prediction. And, you know, since I've, the first has been borne out so far, I'm eager to see how the second plays out. The second was that the Democratic Party will never recover from what it has done to itself in this electoral cycle, and that they are going the way of the Whigs. And I think that the kind of monstrous, unspeakable, demonic brutality that was outlined in your last segment, and the fact that this has been given, you know, full-throated and full-funded support by, you know, this neoliberal murder machine that the Democratic Party has become. I think that the term Democrat is going to sound like the term German National Socialist in 30 or 40 years. I think that when it actually is revealed the extent and the scale of the atrocity and barbarism that this party is responsible for establishing, that they will never recover from it. So I think that the split and the fissure that Dr. Jill was just pointing to with the, we weren't left enough, we were too left, that it's a sign of, you know, of a cleavage that is going to leave that party rent asunder. The corporate wing is going to go full corporate. And what is left of the progressive, you know, element, that part that used to serve working class people, is going to have to find a new home. And yes, we have a lot of work to do to build the Green Party. We have a lot of work to do to kind of institute kind of demographic shift in the Green Party, but just for overall, for where we stand as a movement for representative democracy in the United States of America, we are looking at a situation where between 15 and 20 million people could not hold their nose and vote for these Democrats, right? And another 15 to 20, in my estimation, million held their nose and voted for Trump, right? If they were able to see another visible option instead of having our presence consistently suppressed, then they might move a different direction. So between those two hypothetical voting blocks of 15 to 20 million people and the 82 million that did not vote at all, there is an opportunity for absolutely revolutionary change in this particular moment. And since Dr. Jill quoted you know, one from Malcolm, I'll come with another, you know, never let your enemy tell you how many of you there are. Right. So this kind of perception that, and I don't even think it's a left question, because all of the things that we were running on in this electoral cycle, you know, affordable housing, Medicare for all, you know, stopping corporate corruption, making billionaires pay their fair share, stop bombing kids to death in their sleep in other countries with our tax dollars. All of these things are 70-30 and 80-20 issues with the American people. They could not be more centrist. And I think that a new vision of like how to guide America out of this corporate death spiral that our politics are currently in, I think that that's what people were responding to in our campaign. And it's onwards and upwards from here.
Wow. Well, that's great. And I actually wanted to give you the chance to respond to some critiques. But before I show one of these critiques, and it's going to be from Lawrence O'Donnell, but before I show Lawrence O'Donnell today, I want to show Lawrence O'Donnell from before. Let's take a look at this pretty astute observation he makes, and he has the experience to make it. This is from a bunch of years ago. He's talking about third parties.
If you want to pull the party, the major party that is closest to the way you're thinking, to what you're thinking, you must show them that you're capable of not voting for them. If you don't show them you're capable of not voting for them, they don't have to listen to you. I promise you that. I worked within the Democratic Party. I didn't listen or have to listen to anything on the left while I was working in the Democratic Party, because the left had nowhere to go.
The left had nowhere to go. Now let's fast forward and hear what Lawrence had to say in late October of this year.
Senator Ocasio-Cortez has had enough of Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president.
All you do is show up once every 4 years to speak to people who are justifiably pissed off, but you're just showing up once every 4 years to do that. You're not serious. You're not off to me. It does not read as authentic. It reads as predatory.
Donald Trump became president of the United States thanks to the Electoral College and Jill Stein. The votes that Jill Stein took from Hillary Clinton in key Electoral College states were enough to help Donald Trump win Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Donald Trump is very grateful to Jill Stein. He says that he likes Jill Stein because she takes 100% of her votes from the Democratic candidate for president. And that's why the Harris for President campaign is now running this ad.
Jill Stein, Green Party candidate for president. So why are Trump's close allies helping her? Stein was key to Trump's 2016 wins in battleground states. She's not sorry she helped Trump win. That's why a vote for Stein is really a vote for Trump.
For Jill Stein, I like her very much. You know why? She takes 100% from them.
I'm Kamala Harris, and I approve this message.
I mean, first of all, I'll let you guys respond. But one thing I love is now we're supposed to agree with Trump and take his analysis and his numbers seriously. So, I mean, so much to say. The transition from the old Lawrence to the new Lawrence is fascinating. Although, you know, it's not even contradictory, because he's kind of demonstrating what he said in the first place, right? He's saying that if you want to be able to have any influence, you need a place to go. And he obviously doesn't want there to be that influence. He doesn't want people to have the place to go. So he's actually not even contradicting himself. But what do you guys have to say about his clip? I know you've responded to AOC already. If you have anything new, there, or if not, you can skip to Lawrence, or we can just talk about the ad.
I really need to hear what Jill has to say before I say anything else.
Okay. I mean, to me, it's so like dumb and tired. It's like, I just kind of tune it out, but you know, I don't know that everybody else can do that. So I'll say, you know, at risk of like beating a dead horse here, that we don't go away. It's the media that goes away. It's like, if you don't get that, you know, like, how naive can you be? We're here, we're doing the work, you know, we're fighting against the war in Ukraine. We're fighting for Julian Assange. We're helping lower office candidates, some 140 of them, get elected. We're raising money. You know, AOC's whole analysis is like based on the idea that people-powered parties are the equivalent of billionaire, or I should say, you know, billionaire-sponsored politics. We're not. And in fact, they target us. If they would leave us alone, then yeah, maybe we would be on an even playing field, but they don't. And, you know, they impersonate us. They commit fraud. You know, what they did to Matthew Ho, who was running for Senate. And I was working to help him get elected, you know, among many other candidates. I was not like, didn't have some hole in the sand somewhere. You know, but we're up against Democratic Party, who's not only like funded, you know, in this last race, they were spending the equivalent of our entire budget and more. They had way more staff than we did, simply for the purpose of smearing us. This was their war room. And this was one of the products of their war room. You know, when AOC put out her pathetic, condescending, patronizing, you know, statement from kind of her in her semi-reclined position on her couch, whatever she was doing, pretending she was so casual and natural about this.
Right. Like it was just coming to her in real time.
Yeah, exactly. She was just kind of thinking about this one day, relaxing. No, she's just a total attack dog for the, you know, Democratic Party elites. You know, she's saying like that we are just coming around every 4 years. It's complete nonsense. And when she did that, she got totally dragged on social media in the same way that the head, Jamie Harrison, the head of the DNC, he got totally dragged in the same way that Angela Ray or Rye, whatever her name is, got totally dragged. And the comments, you know, on the Breakfast Club were overwhelmingly, give me a break. You know, I didn't know that there was actually a real choice in this election. I'm going out to register green, you know, which is why they panicked. They completely panicked. They had to suppress the knowledge that of our existence because people are done. They're really done with the Democratic Party and they're staying home. And so they had to conduct this enormous fear campaign. And what she said to my mind is so like, disgust. It's just this disgusting blather. It sort of, you know, sabotages itself. You don't even have to condemn it. But basically, this was complete nonsense, not true. And we did not steal votes. Elections are competition. You're supposed to compete for votes. So that's nonsense. But in addition to that, polls actually showed that people who voted green would not otherwise have voted. And given that one out of every three voters, eligible voters, doesn't come out to vote, don't they deserve a voice? You know, they're basically saying no to these candidates of the political elite and the economic elite being rammed down their throats. Non-voters are largely of color, lower income, and younger. And they don't have skin in this game. Don't they deserve candidates who are fighting for, you know, for rent control, for $25 minimum wage, for healthcare as a human right, for bringing our military dollars, half of our congressional budget, back here to actually meet our needs here at home instead of getting us into trouble on the verge of nuclear war in three places around the world right now? You know, don't voters deserve that too? I mean, it's just such patent nonsense. They can only get away with it because we can't be heard and because they are effectively silencing us. So it's like, to me, it's just like shame on them that they come up with this outrageous stuff. And why do they run these same old tired smears? Because they can't come up with other stuff. You know, if we had some like big corporate contributions or something else that they could smear us with, they would do that. But, you know, it's like I've been in the public eye here for like 12 years at least. So they can't come up with new stuff. So they keep kind of running the same old, really tired, offensive smears. So, you know, I think it's just, it's nonsense. And like, dare to say that to our face when we can actually like rebut it. I dare you. Let's have a debate about this.
Well, and let's also just be clear that they have to issue these kinds of ad hominem attacks because they cannot in any conversation cite policy. Because if they cite policy, then they draw attention to the fact that our policies are the policies that the American people want. So there is no way of actually doing this in politically legitimate fashion except to resort to ad hominem attacks. I'll say one thing, you know, about AOC Pelosi, you know, because, you know, yeah, say her name right. You know, I'll try to paraphrase myself, you know, after she made that little sorry video. You know, what I said was, is that it is really rich coming from AOC Pelosi, who set the land speed record for fastest betrayal of the American people, to talk about other folks being predatory. Predatory is murdering 200,000 people in an open air concentration camp and then telling people that you're supposed to vote. And AOC Pelosi, you know, who likes to play progressive, but is, you know, a Nancy Pelosi clone, you know, a corporate sellout shill for the murderous, hawkish neocon establishment. She likes to cosplay progressive. But she can't, you know, even play the role anymore because she's swimming in filthy cash from, you know, from where she sits. So it's really rich coming from her of all people. But you'll notice that they had to put AOC, then they had to put Keith Ellison, George Takei. So they have to bring out the colored wing of the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party is a plantation. The elites say, you know, the elites say we gotta, you know, come after these leftists, but we gotta hide behind some people of color, gotta make sure people of color do it. Massa say jump, AOC say how high, Keith Ellison say how high, and they go and they put out the hit, they follow the orders, and it's a plantation because they also think that they have ownership of certain demographic groups as part of their voting blocks. When they say you spoiled the election because you stole these votes from us, what they're saying is Black voters belong to us. Latin voters belong to us. And anybody that comes for those voters is taking our voters because we own those voters. They are our property. Stay away from our slaves. So that's the one thing that I would say in response to AOC Pelosi's garbage and nonsense. With respect to Lawrence O'Donnell, this brings another element into the conversation, right? And it brings into play the way that the corporate media has been completely complicit and corrupted in manufacturing consent for this genocide and trying to play nice as though you can oppose a genocide and support a genocider, right? They like to offer token, expressions of, you know, how unfortunate it is that there's a humanitarian crisis and so forth. But let us be clear, there is blood on MSNBC's hands, period. And this is now a media machine that serves to justify Blue MAGA the same way that Fox News works for Red MAGA. And we need independent media options that are not, you know, sucking straight from the teat of, you know, the same AIPAC and war machine sources. Because as long as these are, of course, you're going to see Lawrence O'Donnell. Lawrence O'Donnell knows the difference between right and wrong, but he likes, you know, the paychecks that he receives, you know, from that network. And these are just patronage networks now that serve to justify and reinforce power. They don't serve another function.
Yeah, you know, I think that there are a couple things. One is, like, I think it's not only entitled and problematic to assume that you own people's votes, but it just isn't true. I mean, Ben Jealous is not a fan, with all due respect, Ben Jealous is not a fan of you guys, right? In 2016, people were blaming Jill for Trump's win. And he said, guys, stop it. Most of these people wouldn't have voted for the Democrat anyway. So when they point, when people like Lawrence O'Donnell and Rhodes Scholar Rachel Maddow, who's smart enough to know this, when they point to these numbers that went to Stein and these numbers missing from Hillary, they act as if they definitely would have gone to Hillary, but for Jill Stein, which shows they're either liars or they're not very smart. And it's interesting because, well, pause that for 1 second. Another interesting
can
thing.
Can I just add one quick fact, data point? Yeah. There were two polls came out right before the election that said, that indicated that we were taking as many voters away from Trump as from the Dems anyway. So
more even.
Yeah, there is a Newsweek. Right. I know there was this Newsweek article. Right. It says a new poll, Jill Stein hurts Donald Trump more than Kamala Harris poll suggests, but no one ever talks about that. But the other thing, that I find interesting is I've been very disappointed in Bernie. A lot of people are very disappointed in Bernie. I will say, though, to me, there is an important difference between Bernie stumping for Biden and AOC stumping for Biden. Because Bernie, when he says, and I think he's being honest here, he said, you know, he obviously thinks that Trump is worse than Harris. But he never pretended that she was being a true progressive. She never pretended Harris was being a true progressive. I would have liked for him to have not endorsed, or at the very least tried to get some concessions from her, but he didn't lie about that, at least that aspect of it. But then AOC gets on stage and says she's working tirelessly for a ceasefire, and now not only have you just, like, obviously endorsed them, but your cred is shot with anyone who actually cares about this issue. It was just such a stupid thing to do. I mean, you could make the argument, Bernie made this argument, not whether or not you agree with it, it's not an inherently dishonest, I would say, argument. He says, look, Biden and Harris aren't where I'd like them to be on Gaza, but Trump will be worse. Again, you can agree or disagree. It's not an inherently dishonest argument. I think you can have a political debate about it. But with AOC just saying she's working tirelessly for a ceasefire, it's just an unforced
error. They're gaslighting you. That's all it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wanted to show another clip. I wanted to have you react to another clip, especially because you just brought up the racial element of some of these attacks. So this is a huge fan of this guy. I'm just kidding. Bakari Sellers, who's a literal APAC shill. I mean, there are photos of him with Sheldon Adelson. And I want to show him reacting to Trump's win, especially because I see this as kind of the respectable, polite version of all these blue MAGA people and blue Anon, as Aaron Mate calls them, blue Anon people, who afterwards they were like fantasizing about Mexicans being deported, Latinos being deported, which is also so stupid because they, without realizing it, were revealing how racist they are. They see all Latinos as this monolith. Like, they don't understand that some people are documented, some people aren't documented. It's almost like they were leaning into the racist, xenophobic lie that Trump was pushing, that non-citizens, that illegals, that they were calling them, that illegals were voting, right? Because that was the premise of their, I hope you get deported now. And then, of course, they were celebrating what Trump was going to do to Palestine, right? And they were like, I mean, it was such a masks off moment. Now, someone like Bakari Sellers can't say that. But here's, I think, to me, this looks like the polite version of that. Let's take a look at Bakari Sellers and also see Karen Finney's face when he says that.
There are precincts in Dearborn, Michigan, that Kamala Harris finished third. I think Democrats are going to have this reckoning, and I'm interested to see how a part of our coalition, Arab American voters, those individuals who were pro-Palestinian, are going to analyze this race and what Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the impact that's going to have in the war on Gaza. Because I just go back to Jared Kushner saying that Gaza would be good beachfront property, right? And I'm interested to see how individuals who either set out or chose Jill Stein to punish the Democratic Party are going to reconcile that with what happens with Bibi Netanyahu. I for one, believe we're going to have more chaos.
Okay, so what say ye? More chaos. That's an interesting way to describe genocide, first of all.
May I? I'll try to be brief to leave plenty of room for.
No.
At an event, a campaign event, in New Jersey, probably maybe 80% Muslims at this particular campaign event, I said, Jews don't vote for Nazis. Muslims aren't going to vote for Democrats. What kind of insane white supremacist delusion do you have to be laboring under to think that you can mercilessly slaughter a population for 13 months and then shame them when they do not affirmatively choose you as their representative leadership? And the depth of the BlueAnon moral bankruptcy was revealed then with all of these people saying, I hope you get deported. Wait till they turn Gaza into a parking lot. And these revenge TikToks, like, I can't wait to go back to Starbucks now. I didn't want to do this. I'm going to read one of my own posts. Liberal America's gleeful revenge TikToks about unboycotting Starbucks are every bit as perverse as any IDF selfie. American liberals take a backseat to no one when it comes to reveling in white supremacy with naked joy. We have been the world's teachers in this since the 18th century, before the Zionist entity was even a racist pipe dream. Enjoy your unethically sourced union-busting beverages. It always tasted like ash. Apparently, the secret ingredient is charred corpses. So this is what the naked underbelly of the Democratic Party is. And this is what Malcolm Jones, our first conversation, you had a paraphrase of Malcolm before I joined the campaign and that I followed through on. Malcolm said, the liberal is a fox. It bears its teeth and you think it's smiling at you, but you are on the menu. The conservative is the wolf. It bears its teeth and you know its intent. What Gaza has done, what this last electoral cycle has done, it has revealed the naked white supremacy that lies at the root of teams blue and red alike. And this is why they love fixating on Trump, because holier than thou liberals get to point like Tony Montana in Scarface and say, look, there's the bad guy. That guy's the bad guy. The racism is over there. And are not forced to confront the absolutely murderous white supremacist and imperialist policies that they have been fostering and nurturing and cultivating since Bill Clinton.
Yeah. Do you want to respond, Jill, or I want to point something out, but you can respond first. Or
I can be really brief. I don't have much to add to that, except to say when I see these disgusting talking heads, you know, there's nothing that draws me in, you know, and I'm reminded that, you know, that there are many polls that keep coming out to say that the majority of the American people understand that mainstream media is their enemy, and that people understand that mainstream media is purposefully misleading them, and people regard what mainstream media says as a pack of lies. And I don't really follow mainstream media or even the critique of it, because, you know, to my mind, that's not really how we build the fight back. You know, it's not about debunking media. That comes in handy every now and then, but really it's like it's building the force. But, you know, my understanding is that the MSNBCs are really crashing and burning now, and, you know, that they've had massive loss of, you know, viewership and all that, which they absolutely should. And this is, you know, this is like part of it, you know, and it, to my mind, it's like, well, of course, who wouldn't turn that off? You know, who wouldn't kind of go running with your hair on fire after listening to that kind of self-serving, you know, really economic elite serving analysis? So truth to tell, I don't even spend time thinking about it. I just really sort of feel sorry for people who are in that orbit and who are like addicted, you know, to that kind of manufactured consent for some reason, and they keep listening to it because people mostly seem to be breaking up with it now. And I think that's great. And I personally do not feel obliged or motivated to debunk it at all.
Yeah. I will just say that Karen Finney, the woman who was like, when he said that, she is such a perfect MSNBC head because she is so good at weaponizing like racism or anti-written. She's so good at weaponizing anti-racism for racist ends. Like I always remember Bernie Sanders during, you know, back in 2020, I think it was, he was the only one on the debate stage who said that he was, or it's a town hall, I think, he was the only one who said he was against the death penalty, even for the Boston bomber. Like one of those stupid emotional questions where you bring up a bad example and that's supposed to violate your principles. And Karen Finney, I remember her response to that was, I guess she's a CNN head, sorry, not an MSNBC head, I can't remember. But her response to that was that opposing the death penalty was racist because James Byrd, that, and this is an awful story, obviously, I don't know, people may not remember this, he was a black man who was dragged to death following a pickup truck. It was disgusting, disgusting. But because he was killed by white racists, the death penalty is anti-racist. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you had this person defending one of the most racist mechanisms in our country, which happens to be about literal life and death. You had her in the name of anti-racism defending it. Anyway, that's just a little rant I have about that particular person. I'm going to ask you about, I'll end the show asking you about moving forward and what's next, but what critiques do you have? Any regrets? Like, is there anything that you guys could have done, should have been aware of, that could have resulted in a better turnout for the Greens?
Personally, I don't think so. And, you know, this is my third presidential race, and I feel like, you know, it's a real tribute, actually, to the Greens that we stand up and we refuse to be silenced. And we insisted that genocide be front and center in this election. And we gave people a way to fight back about genocide and empire and oligarchy and climate collapse. I think, you know, in the same way that Butch is saying, you know, the Democratic Party is, you know, has a real, they are going to be judged by history here. I think we are too, you know, and I can, I could not in good conscience have bitten my tongue and said, oh no, this is going to be way too controversial a race. I would have loved if someone could have done this in my place, but under the circumstances, that wasn't going to happen. We had a vacancy where Dr. West decided he wanted to run solo for understandable reasons, but we didn't exactly have a lot of lead time, and we had to pull a viable campaign together very quickly, and it was going to be either Ajamu Baraka or myself, and he won the argument, so I inherited the race, and he, you know, was mostly not living in the country, so he had a good reason. But to me, it's like there were so many people telling me not to do it. And had I been, you know, if this was about me, I wouldn't have done it.
Right.
That's not an easy race to run.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I know you don't want to debunk things, but I do think it's worth noting that like a lot of this narrative that you're this egomaniac narcissist who keeps running. I mean, first of all, you didn't run in 2020. Yeah. And also, I mean, I wasn't in the rooms, but there seems to be, you know, consensus that you were not trying to run. You ran because there was a vacancy.
I was trying very hard not to run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree, you know, that you know, and me getting pulled in out of academia, you know, literally like cold, you know, off the bench, you know, like you can run tape 20 years, you know, of organizing and educational work. You will not find me talking about running for elected office. So that was, you know, you know, its own experience, its own, you know, learning curve. And I would, you know, certainly say that that there's a lot of things that I personally could do better. I don't believe in holding the Dems accountable for their, you know, catastrophic failures, and the Republicans, you know, accountable for their catastrophic failures, and not being self-reflexive about my own. So there's a lot of things that I feel personally, you know, that I could do better. The one thing that I'll say,
like what?
I think that if I had had a clearer perception the kind of scale of groundwork that was really going to be needed, I probably would have put as much time and attention into that as to the media work and the social media work and the things that were about raising visibility. I think that hindsight is always 20/20. So, and I try to take lessons from every single, you know, victory and every single defeat. And this campaign came with both, as far as I was concerned. The one thing that I would just say is that a really crucial, you know, kind of, there's a couple of really, really crucial opportunities that come out of this. The first, for me as like, you know, someone who's known predominantly as like a scholar of Islam and, you know, who writes about Islamic history, African history, you know, the Black radical tradition, 53% of American Muslims, according to exit polling, voted for us in this election. We got 2.5 times, 53% for us, 20% for Trump, 20% for Kamala. So we got 2.5 times the votes in the Muslim community as either of those parties. There is a major opportunity for Muslim Americans, and there's 2.5 million, you know, Muslim Americans that are eligible to vote, that there's a major opportunity to like assert political leadership in a kind of vocal way. And there's now the third largest political party in the United States of America that can be expressive of, you know, kind of the political yearnings and aspirations of a population that has been systematically demonized since 9/11. So there's a real opportunity for like ethical leadership and political leadership from the Muslim community in forming a broader anti-imperialist coalition that really has the opportunity to be kind of galvanized in this moment. My own personal response, you know, has been to like declare early my intention to run for governor in the state of California, because I do not intend to let anybody say that we just show up every 4 years. I am going to keep the foot on people's necks and especially make this these communities that have been trying desperately to organize to try to resist this corporate duopoly, to give our communities every opportunity to continue to grow, coming out of this this electoral cycle. I was so mad in the first 24 hours after the election, I couldn't talk to anyone. Like I was that bitterly disappointed with the electoral results. And then, you know, 24 hours later, you get up and you start building and you start thinking about how to take lessons, you know, from that which was successful and that which was less successful, and build, you know, an even stronger resistance movement going forward.
What did you expect electorally?
Me personally, or are you asking us collectively?
Start with you personally, then Jill. Because you just mentioned yet you were disappointed. So I'm just curious where you're coming from.
No. It wasn't disappointment with respect to expectations. I mean, I'm literally like very much a practicing Sufi Muslim. I believe that outcomes are beyond my control and I don't control them. I don't seek to control them. What I'm responsible for is like my preparation, my intentionality, and my attention to detail. So anything short of the White House was going to be a disappointment for me. No matter what, losing was going to be a bitter disappointment for me regardless. Sure. Yeah.
But did you hope, I mean, I'm sure you hoped, did you expect 5% or something closer to 5% than you guys got?
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.